Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1190, I will have a couple of segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip and the ongoing Israeli destruction and attacks in the West Bank. During the second segment, I will air several of the remarks delivered at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey in October 2025. We will listen to the remarks of Lily Greenberg Kohl, the first Jewish-American political appointee to resign from the Biden-Harris administration over its policies in Gaza. Her talk is titled Government Complicity in Genocide. I will also air the remarks of Yanis Varoufakis, economist, politician, and activist, addressing the capitalist dynamics fueling and reinforcing the genocide of the Palestinian people. His talk is titled Capitalism and Related Structural Dynamics Behind the Genocide. We will also listen to the remarks of Dr. Osama Maqdisi, professor of history at UC Berkeley, addressing why Palestinians have been systematically dehistoricized and rendered a people without history or ethical importance. His talk is titled Root Causes Drawing on Historical Perspective. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Barros Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Barros Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 762 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. In Gaza, Israel has continued to routinely kill and injure Palestinians in spite of the October 10th ceasefire, while desperately needed humanitarian aid, including shelter materials, medicine, basic food items, and supplies for infrastructure repair, remain blocked, and as most of the crossings remain closed. On Wednesday, Israel killed two Palestinians in separate incidents, claiming that they had crossed the so-called yellow line where the Israeli army maintains control. Al Jazeera reported that little information has been given about the location of this line, and it is still being physically marked on the ground, presenting another deadly hazard for Palestinians. Reporter Ibrahim Said documented the invisible partition in northern Gaza, where Palestinians explain that they cannot reach their homes and belongings and are constantly threatened by Israeli snipers and tanks. On Tuesday, November 4th, one Palestinian was killed and another was wounded when an Israeli quadcopter drone opened fire in eastern Gaza City. And another was killed in Jabalia in northern Gaza, again with the Israeli army claiming that they fired on the individual for crossing the so-called yellow line. Palestinians were shot and wounded by Israeli forces on Monday, November 3rd, in southern Gaza. Civil defense spokesperson Mahmoud Bassal said that Israeli forces opened fire on a wedding in the eastern Gaza City neighborhood of Shujaiya that same day, wounding several children, including an 8-year-old girl, Sundus Helles. Bassal said that the attack took place inside the so-called Safe Yellow Line zone in that part of eastern Gaza City, an area designated under the U.S.-brokered ceasefire as a first-phase boundary where Israeli occupation forces were meant to withdraw and halt all aggression. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated this week that since the beginning of the ceasefire, 219 Palestinians have been killed, including 85 children. Across the eastern, northern, and southern parts of the Gaza Strip, beyond where the Israeli army has designated the vague yellow line boundary, Israel has continued to use bombs and airstrikes to evaporate entire blocks and destroy any trace of Palestinian homes, agricultural land, and infrastructure. Euromed said that these actions, quote, suggest Israel is consolidating a new reality, allowing itself to conduct continuous military operations in areas it controls, covering roughly 50% of Gaza, while removing these areas from the ceasefire framework without engaging in combat operations aimed solely at destruction or eliminating future livelihoods. Five Palestinian fishermen were arrested on Tuesday after Israeli gunboats opened fire on their fishing boats just off the Gaza port, quote, forcing fishermen to jump into the water before being bound and arrested, according to a statement by the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. Israel continues to ban Palestinians from fishing despite the ceasefire agreement. Palestinian bodies that were returned to Gaza by Israel this week were so badly decomposed that they were difficult to identify, according to a Gaza Health Ministry official who spoke to Al Jazeera on Wednesday. The official said that one of the returned bodies was missing a head. Bodies have been routinely returned to Gaza with visible signs of field executions and torture. Health officials say efforts to identify the remains have also been hindered because Israel is not allowing DNA testing equipment into Gaza, Al Jazeera noted. The Ministry of Health said that 285 Palestinian bodies have been received since October 10th, but only 84 of those have been identified. Israel continues to use food and healthcare as weapons, 25 months into the genocide and nearly 4 weeks into a so-called ceasefire. The Gaza government media office stated that since October 10th, only 145 trucks on average daily are entering Gaza, which is fewer than one quarter of the agreed-upon minimum of 600 trucks that should be entering in order to meet the basic needs of Palestinians. The media office added that only 10% of the anticipated 1,100 fuel trucks have entered as well, quote, reflecting the continued policy of deliberately restricting and obstructing the vital energy supplies needed to operate hospitals, bakeries, and essential facilities. The Norwegian Refugee Council says that they are one of 9 international humanitarian aid agencies that have faced repeated rejections by Israel, blocking them from bringing in life-saving shelter materials as winter and the rainy season approaches. Quote, since the ceasefire took effect on October 10th, Israeli authorities have rejected 23 requests from 9 aid agencies to bring in urgently needed shelter supplies, such as tents, ceiling and framing kits, bedding, kitchen sets, and blankets, amounting to nearly 4,000 pallets. Humanitarian organizations warn that the window to scale up winterization assistance is closing rapidly, the group said on Wednesday. The Norwegian Refugee Council's regional director, Angelita Kareda, said that, quote, we have a very short chance to protect families from the winter rains and cold. More than 3 weeks into the ceasefire, Gaza should be receiving a surge of shelter materials, but only a fraction of what is needed has entered. The international community must act now to secure swift and unimpeded access. At least 259,000 Palestinian families, more than 1.45 million people, need emergency shelter assistance, the group added. Meanwhile, Israeli forces abducted a worker with UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, on October 30th, while he was working at one of the only two crossings that are partially open for humanitarian aid deliveries. Raed Al-Afifi was detained and taken by Israeli forces, and Euromed Human Rights Monitor says that, quote, no information has been provided by Israeli authorities regarding his location or the charges against him. Euromed says that in a related development, the Israeli army, quote, had requested UNICEF to withdraw its trucks and supplies from Kerem Shalom a day before the arrest, and subsequently prevented the entry of aid trucks carrying medical equipment for hospitals in northern Gaza, as well as vaccinations for newborns and nutritional supplements. The targeting of UNICEF, the group says, is part of a broader campaign to restrict United Nations agencies and international humanitarian organizations, aiming to end their presence and operations after they witnessed widespread violations affecting Palestinian civilians during the war and to further deprive the population of livelihoods and essential services in Gaza. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have escalated their attacks and destruction in the northern city of Tulkarem, with extensive bulldozing operations in the Tulkarem refugee camp, which has been under siege for more than 280 days. The Wafa news agency reported that Israeli soldiers have tightened military measures and closed all entrances to the camp, preventing residents from reaching their homes. Barriers, including iron gates and concrete blocks, have been installed in the camp and in the city's neighborhoods adjacent to the camp, and have seized nearby homes and turned them into military bases. Wafa reports that, quote, this escalation comes as the aggression and siege on the nearby Nor Shams camp enters the 270th consecutive day. Local journalist Wafaya Al-Hadi recorded this protest on Wednesday as residents demanded the right to return to their homes and rejected forced displacement. Wafa news agency said that the Israeli soldiers blocked their advance and forced them to disperse at gunpoint. More than 5,000 families have been displaced from Tulkarem and Nor Shams refugee camps in the past 10 months, and more than 600 homes have been destroyed, leaving the camps uninhabitable. Israeli soldiers and settlers carried out nearly 2,400 attacks across the occupied West Bank during the month of October alone, according to statistics from the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission in Palestine. The army was responsible for nearly 1,600 of the assaults, and settlers carried out nearly 800. Quote, the attacks ranged from direct physical assaults, uprooting of trees, burning of fields, preventing olive pickers from reaching their lands, seizing property, and demolishing homes and agricultural facilities. On the other hand, the occupation forces are closing large areas of land under the pretext of enforcing security, while the colonizers are granted expansion within said lands, the commission stated. Wafa News reported that Jewish Israeli settlers attacked and injured three Palestinians west of Yatta, south of Al-Khalil, on Wednesday. The settlers released their livestock into the fields, damaged crops and fruit trees, and then physically assaulted the residents, leaving three with injuries. Settlers also destroyed olive groves in the village of Turmusaya on Wednesday, setting fires that damaged fruit-bearing trees, causing losses for farmers and threatening this year's olive harvest. The Turmusaya lands and surrounding areas are subjected to frequent and repeated attacks by settlers, especially in recent weeks. And settlers carried out a gruesome attack on sheep owned by Palestinian farmers this past week in the southern West Bank. Footage from a surveillance camera shows nine masked Israeli settlers armed with clubs raiding the property of the Dramin family on the outskirts of the village of Samu in the South Hebron Hills. The video shows the settlers, quote, shattering windshields and torching harvests as three of the men enter the sheep pen and beat lambs in front of the ewes. The security camera filmed one of the settlers throwing lambs onto the floor, throwing concrete blocks at them and beating them as another settler hit the others. Six lambs were killed and four others were severely injured, the Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz reported. Other sources indicated that some of the lambs had their eyes gouged out by the settlers. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight When We Couldn't Offer Family Shelter by Hassan Abu Kamar, writing from Gaza. He writes about trying desperately a couple of months ago to find adequate shelter for 16 of his relatives in the north who decided to try and flee south, as Hassan says, due to the ferocity of Israel's indiscriminate bombing. Quote, our four-room home was already jammed with our family of six, plus my aunt, her husband, and their two sons, one with his wife and three daughters. They pleaded with my father to find them an apartment or a roof or any piece of land where they could pitch their tents. "The situation here is so dangerous," my cousin Maisara said. "We don't want to die." My father asked them to wait until the end of the day when he tried to find a solution. As he hung up, I sprang to my feet. "How? There's absolutely no place," I asked in disbelief. "What could we do? Abandon them and watch them die?" my father replied in anger, exasperated from the trying circumstances that were visited upon us. In November 2023, my cousin's home was bombed while they were inside. 16 of my cousins were killed, and many others were injured. This time we could lose them all if we did nothing. We needed to find them a place. My brother, Hussein, and I searched the streets of Nuseirat for any place, a task that felt like searching for a needle in a haystack. Hussein also made calls and checked social media, but prices were unimaginable. My brother and I returned home that evening after almost 4 hours of searching Nuseirat and then nearby Al Zuwaida, finding nothing but prices soaring beyond reason. I wished to die rather than to deliver the bitter truth. We couldn't find any place. I told my father that he could offer our cousins my room instead of simply saying there was nowhere for them to go. He called our cousins with the speakerphone on and explained that we couldn't find a place. Then he offered, "You can have a room, a bathroom, and use our kitchen to cook." Some of them laughed, not out of amusement, but despair. They thanked my father and declined the offer. Then they pondered among themselves before telling my father that they decided to stay in northern Gaza, not as an act of resilience, but because there's no place in the south. "We prefer to die in an airstrike than from famine," Maisara said. When a ceasefire was announced on October 9th, we contacted our cousins immediately. "Alhamdulillah, all of this has ended," Maisara said. His previously tense and strained voice now carried relief but cautious optimism. "For an entire month, we didn't leave the boundaries of our street out of fear." My father, our family, and I felt an overwhelming sense of relief as a weight had been lifted off our shoulders. My cousins are safe, for now, at least, but remain deeply anxious, unsure of whether Israel will once again break the ceasefire. Those are excerpts from When We Couldn't Offer Family Shelter by Hassan Abu Qamar, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Students at Al-Azhar University in Gaza City are registering for classes after 2 years of trying to complete their education while also trying to survive a genocide. In a short video produced by Middle East Eye, one student says that she hopes to finally obtain her right to education, including by taking in-person classes. Mohammed Shabir, a university administrator, says that in the third year of this war, they were happily surprised that the number of student registrants was higher than any year before. He says, quote, "This demonstrates that there is living, undying Palestinian will in the hearts of all of our students."
أتمنى أن أخذ حقوقي في التعليم وأن تستمر الجامعة في التعليم الوجاهي وأن نستمر لما كنت عليه ما قبل الحرب. هذه أبسط حقوقي.
الجامعة تستقبل يعني دائما فبداية كل عام دراسي قبل الحرب ما يقارب 4000 طالب. المفاجأة السارة أننا في هذه السنة وفي السنة الثالثة للحرب وجدنا أن العدد أكبر من ذلك بكثير، وهو إن دل فإنما يدل على أن هناك إرادة فلسطينية حية لا تموت في قلب وجدان كل طلبتنا الأعزاء.
مصرين على إنه إحنا نتعلم ونحاول نسمع شوية، يعني نعيد شوية من حياتنا القديمة، وإن شاء الله يعني بيصير خير وبترجع غزة زي ما كانت.
شعور الآن وأنا اليوم في داخل جامعة ميدان جامعة الأزهر شعور جدا رائع، شعور بالفخر، شعور تحقق جزء من الحلم.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The Gaza Tribunal, an independent international initiative investigating war crimes and acts of genocide committed by apartheid Israel in the Gaza Strip, held its final session in Istanbul, Turkey, in October 2025, an event that lasted 4 days and was full of great speakers, testimonies, remarks, speeches, experts speaking about the genocide in Gaza. I had aired previously on this program some of the remarks delivered at the different stages and sessions of the Gaza Tribunal held in different countries over the past year, and I'm going to air now three of the remarks delivered in October 2025 at the Gaza Tribunal final session, including the remarks of Lily Greenberg Call, the first Jewish American political appointee to resign from the Biden-Harris administration over its policies in Gaza, speaking about government complicity in genocide. Then we will listen to the remarks of Yanis Varoufakis, economist, politician, and activist, addressing the capitalist dynamics fueling and reinforcing the genocide of the Palestinian people. And I will end by airing the remarks of Dr. Osama Maqdisi, professor of history at UC Berkeley, addressing why Palestinians have been systematically dehistoricized and rendered a people without history or ethical importance. Here is Lily Greenberg Call, the first Jewish American political appointee to resign in May 2024 from the Biden-Harris administration over its policies in Gaza. Her talk is titled Government Complicity in Genocide.
My name is Lily Greenberg Call. Until May 2024, I served as a special advisor to the Chief of Staff at the U.S. Department of the Interior. I was a political appointee in the Biden administration. I'm here to testify to the complicity of the United States government in what the world now recognizes as the genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza. I speak in my personal capacity as a Jewish American, as a former government official, and as a human being who decided that I could no longer be a part of an administration that was enabling mass death. I joined the Biden administration in January 2023 after working in the campaigns. I am a part of a generation of young public servants who believed that we were restoring moral leadership after the first Trump administration. And my work at the Department of Interior focused on climate, environmental policy, and protecting our natural resources. Although I was not in a national security agency, I witnessed through internal communications, appointee briefings, interagency coordination, and my interactions with senior White House officials, how the administration responded to events following October 7th, 2023. And I also witnessed the internal environment of fear, censorship, and moral paralysis that defined the administration's position towards Israel's assault on Gaza. My testimony draws from those experiences, from communications among colleagues, and from the public record that is now overwhelmingly demonstrates U.S. knowledge of and participation in Israel's genocidal campaign. After the attack on October 7, 2023, which killed 1,200 Israelis and took hostages, there was widespread grief throughout the administration. And I will add that that attack was something that hit me personally and my community very hard. I grew up in a very close and tight-knit Jewish community with friends and family in the United States and in Israel. And many people I know lost family members and loved ones on October 7th. The grief that I felt and that everyone felt after that was legitimate and deeply felt. And that grief was recognized very clearly by my colleagues in the administration. But almost immediately, it felt like grief was replaced with a directive for total political alignment with the Israeli government, regardless of its actions. There was an almost immediate cloud that kind of came over everyone working in government. colleagues who had been in service much longer than me compared it to post 9/11, and some even to the Vietnam era, where it felt like they could not express any disagreement with US policy. Especially as an appointee, I served at the pleasure of the president. So those of us who were political appointees, I think, felt even more pressure to echo the president's public statements that emphasize Israel's right to defend itself, you know, omit any knowledgement or acknowledgement of international law or civilian protection. And when internal questions arose about proportionality, aid access, or the scope of military support, they were met with silence or reprimand. To me, this was the beginning, at least in the post-October 7th landscape, of the United States' active complicity in the genocide, the deliberate decision to subordinate moral, legal, and humanitarian obligations in favor of political loyalty. Of course, I acknowledge and recognize that U.S. complicity in the genocide of the Palestinian people has been happening for many, many years. And I often echoed this statement to senior White House officials. When I was asked about my opinions on what was happening, I spoke as a Jewish American who was deeply impacted by October 7th and often told people that I did not feel unsafe as a Jew because of Hamas's attack, and I did not feel unsafe because of anything that the Palestinian people or any rhetoric I was experiencing from Arab or Muslim colleagues in the administration or fellow Americans. What made me feel unsafe was the United States' support and enabling of Israel's system of apartheid and inequality and occupation that created the conditions for October 7th to happen. So it felt like by mid-October, I was hearing from other colleagues about intelligence and humanitarian briefings from across agencies that documented the scale of the destruction in Gaza, that thousands of civilians were killed in weeks, that entire neighborhoods were bombed, that warnings from aid organizations of imminent collapse of medical and food systems were going ignored. And these reports circulated internally, and they circulated informally in signal group chats and among conversation. I know senior officials were aware of them, and I and others received updates confirming that the US government knew in real time that the continued arms transfers and diplomatic cover were facilitating war crimes. By November, thousands of US officials across multiple agencies had signed internal dissent cables or open letters calling for a ceasefire, and none of these warnings changed policy. The president continued to approve weapons shipments. The administration vetoed multiple UN Security Council resolutions calling for a ceasefire. And the justification, often repeated internally, was that halting support would undermine US credibility and embolden our adversaries. In truth, there was acknowledgement among government officials that this was not a policy problem. This was a political problem. This was about maintaining political control and avoiding confrontation with the pro-Israel lobby here in America. A pro-Israel lobby that, I might add, has become increasingly co-opted by Christian nationalists and Christian Zionists who have no interest in the safety of American Jews or Israeli Jews or any minority community, and have enabled and propped up the Trump administration, the MAGA regime, and the Christian nationalist alt-right authoritarian leadership that we are seeing currently. So from my understanding, and again, I was not part of any agency that was responsible for these acts of complicity, but I believe that the US government's complicity in the Gaza genocide took several concrete forms: material support, bombs, missiles, artillery shells, diplomatic protection, the US using its veto power at the United Nations to block international ceasefire efforts and investigations and shield Israel from accountability under international law, rhetorical cover, senior officials consistently repeated Israel's false narratives, calling hospitals terrorist command centers or claiming that there were no credible alternative to military operations, which we knew was false, and especially displayed by the November 2023 deal that brought back many, many more hostages than any military operation. And then, of course, censorship and retaliation. So within the administration, the culture of silence meant that employees who spoke out faced professional isolation and threats to their careers, something that I experienced personally before I even resigned publicly. So this culture of fear ensured a continued silence and bureaucratic obedience. Inside my department, many people spoke about Gaza. It was not spoken about publicly, but privately, this dominated conversations among staff. I knew people both inside my department and across government were grieving and horrified and desperate for guidance. Sometimes within my agency, we were told that foreign policy is not our lane, to which I was very frustrated because this administration, the Biden administration, had made a concrete effort to hire appointees who were younger and more diverse than ever before. And I know that many of my Muslim and Arab colleagues expressed their frustration to senior officials, especially when their families were telling them that they should resign, that the administration was complicit in genocide and committing war crimes. And this sentiment was often expressed to senior White House leadership of, why did you hire us if you're not interested in what we actually have to bring to the table and what our communities have to say? I observed colleagues from across the administration express a quiet despair. They knew that what Israel was doing in Gaza was morally indefensible. They knew that it was terrible, not just for Palestinians, but for Israelis as well, and also for Americans to be associated with and known as the enablers of these crimes. Senior officials in defense and military agencies knew that the US supplied weapons were being used in civilian areas and indiscriminate bombings of civilian areas. And so in December, when the International Court of Justice began considering South Africa's genocide case against Israel, the internal reaction in the administration was one of contempt, not reflection. It was mocked as political theater, and no one really questioned at a high level, I believe, what it meant for our own legal exposure. Ultimately, by early 2024, it became impossible for me to reconcile my service with my conscience. And I felt that I was doing everything I could from inside, whether that was organizing people across government to participate in vigils, to sign on to anonymous letters that got thousands of signatories, to have one-on-one conversations with their bosses, to see what levers of power we could pull internally. And ultimately, it felt like I had done everything I could. And there was no change that was being made. So I decided to resign in May of 2024, stating publicly that I could no longer represent a president that enabled the killing, starvation, and displacement of millions of Palestinians. I was the first Jewish political appointee, and unfortunately the only, to resign publicly over the genocide. I know that there were many others, Jewish appointees, who left the administration in large part because of Gaza, but did not do so publicly. I resigned also very close to the holiday of Passover, which is a holiday that is about liberation from oppression. And I remember in 2024, when I was celebrating Passover, knowing deep in my heart that the lesson to take from that holiday was to speak truth to power, to be like Moses in Pharaoh's kingdom, even when it means going against your community, or the people who raised you, or the power that you've benefited from. My resignation was not in opposition to my Jewishness, right? It was because of it. Everything I've ever learned about what it means to be Jewish is that human life is of infinite value, and that to remain silent in the face of injustice is to participate in it. And I want to underscore that my resignation was not a heroic act. It was an act of moral survival. It was an acknowledgement of an understanding with myself that this was the biggest and most important thing I could do in the moment to potentially save lives. And that if I did not do that, I would be failing myself spiritually, morally, and I would not be the person that I want to be in this world. Remaining in that position would have meant accepting the destruction of an entire people as collateral damage. And in particular, the destruction of an entire people in the name of my people's supposed safety, with a president who was repeating that rhetoric consistently. By the end of 2024, the official record was that over 40,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza, and I am certain, and we know, that the real number is much, much more. Independent investigations have confirmed that Israel deliberately targeted civilian infrastructure, hospitals, schools, aid convoys. Famine has spread as Israel blocked fuel and food. Tent camps in Rafah were bombed, and all of this was done with U.S. weapons funded by U.S. taxpayers and defended by U.S. diplomats. The administration could not claim ignorance. Every major humanitarian organization warned of the unfolding genocide. And yet the president continued to say Israel was acting within the bounds of international law, while also, regardless of international law, Israel was explicitly breaking the U.S.'s own laws, the Leahy laws, about military aid. This was not mere negligence. It was a conscious political choice. And I know why this happens, in part because of my own experience with the Israel lobby in the United States, decades of unconditional military aid, political lobbying, and the normalization of Palestinian dehumanization in our politics. Lobbying groups like AIPAC and CUFI, Christians United for Israel, exert enormous influence on U.S. policy, shaping foreign aid and the boundaries of public speech. And elected officials often fear being labeled anti-Semitic if they even question Israeli actions or bring up conditioning aid, while Palestinians and their allies are criminalized for demanding freedom. This structural corruption makes accountability nearly impossible. What I think needs to happen, one of the many things that I think needs to happen, more than acknowledgement, there needs to be an immediate suspension of all U.S. military aid and armed transfers to Israel, full cooperation with internal investigations into genocide and war crimes, reparations, humanitarian reconstructions for Gaza, protections for whistleblowers and dissenters, and structural reforms to end the influence of militarized and foreign lobbying on American policy. And only through such measures can the U.S. begin to atone for its role in this atrocity and prevent future ones. Thank you.
That was Lily Greenberg Cole, the first Jewish American political appointee to resign in May 2024 from the Biden-Harris administration over its policies in Gaza, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session in October 2025. Let's listen next to the remarks of Yanis Varoufakis, economist, politician, and activist, addressing the capitalist dynamics fueling and reinforcing the genocide of the Palestinian people, also speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session in October 2025. His talk is titled Capitalism and Related Structural Dynamics Behind the Genocide.
My name is Yanis Varoufakis. I'm an economist, a politician, and an activist representing Greece's Mera 25 party, as well as the pan-European radical movement DiEM25. And I'm here in my capacity as an expert on the manner in which capitalist dynamics are fueling and reinforcing the genocide of the Palestinian people. Today, with a view to assisting the jury to reach an informed verdict, I shall address the economic forces underpinning the complicity of global capital in initially the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and more recently their genocide. The jury should want to keep in mind that genocide pays, and I shall be arguing later, it pays a great deal more now that a new form of capital has evolved and is involved in the execution of genocide. To begin, the jury should want to acknowledge that capitalism thrives on human misery and in sheer destruction. There is therefore no great paradox in the fact that at a time when demand for goods and services, production, and consumer confidence are falling precipitously in Israel, nevertheless, at this very same time, the Israeli stock exchange not only did not fall since the Gaza genocide began, but in fact, it rose by more than 160%. This reflects the underlying political economy of occupation, and in particular, the manner in which thousands of Israeli companies are intertwined with American, European, Korean merger corporations, as well as one large Brazilian company, shamefully, including the world's weightiest financial conglomerates, all that comprising an international network that kicked into overdrive after October 2023. The moment the Israeli defense budget doubled, it crowded into Israel's financial circuits, large investments, and therefore enablers of its killing machine. For more detailed information on this, the jury should take into account the excellent report to the United Nations published by Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. The report, Francesca's report, is entitled From Economy of Occupation to economy of genocide. Of course, none of this is new, per se. History teaches us that economic interests have been key drivers and enablers of colonial enterprises, and often of the genocides they perpetrated. The corporate sector has been intrinsic to colonialism since its inception, with corporations beginning with the Dutch and the British East India Companies, historically contributing to the violence against the exploitation of, and ultimately, the dispossession of indigenous people and lands, a mode of domination known as racial colonial capitalism. Israel's colonization of the occupied Palestinian lands could not have been an exception. The jury should be aware of the manner in which Palestine today demonstrates all three phases of colonial expropriation. First came the phase of unsophisticated, brutalist expropriation, the brutal plunder of land and the conversion of indigenous people into either refugees or, more likely, cheap and even slave labor. That phase, which led to the rise of capitalism in the 18th century, has been evidenced in Palestine at least since the Balfour Declaration, and much, much more so during and in the aftermath of the Nakba. Palestinian land was brutally expropriated, and the Palestinians either turned into refugees or encased in Bantustans, which ended up, until at least the Second Intifada, providing cheap labor to the colonizers. Now, turning to the second phase of modern colonialism, also known as neo-imperialism, that did not so much concern the plunder of land as it was intended to secure markets for the surplus commodities produced in the capitalist metropolis, commodities that the capitalist metropolis could not absorb domestically due to insufficient domestic demand. The neo-imperialist dimension also made its appearance in Palestine in connection to the plight of the Palestinian people, as Israel began to absorb massive quantities of weaponry imported from the United States, from Germany, from the United Kingdom and elsewhere. Imports into Israel that contributed significantly to the aggregate demand of the exporting countries. More recently still, the Israeli arms manufacturers have managed to enter this game as exporters by exporting high-tech weaponry tried and tested on the Palestinian population, exporting those technologies to foreign countries, including, shamefully, to my own country, Greece, but also to Arab countries, too. Let's not forget that. And that brings me to the third phase of contemporary capital accumulation, feeding expropriation at home and colonialism abroad. The phase which I like to refer to as the techno-feudal phase, a phase underpinned by the accumulation of a new radical form of capital, which I have entitled, I've called cloud capital. War, ladies and gentlemen, was always lucrative. Arms dealers made fortunes from supplying weapons to the highest bidder. Indirectly, all sorts of capital, including capital that produced consumer goods, accumulated faster at times of war and destruction. But in this techno-feudal age phase that I'm referring to, cloud capital, this new radical form of capital, accumulates new powers in the battlefields. How? Directly by improving its algorithms, capacity to understand and to manipulate humans. Nothing helps cloud capital improve its efficiency than the real-time experience of monitoring and manipulating the behavior of combatants, of target selectors, those people in the military who select targets, of the politicians that enable these target selectors, and yes, tragically, of the population targeted for annihilation. The jury will want to note that cloud capital is a network of machines comprising smartphones, tablets, servers, algorithms, a network of machines which does something remarkable. We train it, this network of machines, to train us, to train it, that network of machines, to know us well enough, and eventually to manipulate our behavior, therefore imparting, giving the owners of this cloud capital, exorbitant powers to do things to us against our will in their interest. In this context, the jury should want to take into account the fact that no country in the world has given as much access to a population's biometric data as Israel has given, let's say, to a company like IBM. And since the Gaza genocide began, Microsoft, Amazon, Alphabet, that is Google, and Palantir, let's not forget Palantir, have been expanding their cloud capital penetration at a breathtaking pace. Face recognition software, target selection algorithms, and automated execution systems are being tested in real time, at will, and with fewer ethical constraints than in the case of experiments on laboratory rats. America's big tech, Silicon Valley, could not be happier with the genocide. The jury should therefore be aware of the fact that today's AI targeting devices that maximize death and destruction in Gaza will tomorrow morning power up the Amazon or Google or Microsoft algorithms, which make us buy stuff we neither need nor want, algorithms which poison our conversations in our social media here in the West, that drive increasingly dispossessed proletarians, drivers, nurses, and warehouse workers. In other words, I call upon the jury to note that what is happening in Palestine, the unfolding ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the genocide in Gaza, is totally intertwined with the forms of exploitation and the toxification of our social milieu in the rest of the world. In this sense, yes, our freedom in the rest of the world is certainly connected with the liberation of Palestinians from colonialism, expropriation, fear, and manipulation. To conclude, I would like to thank the jury for its important work and to implore its members to pay attention to the manner in which capitalist dynamics, especially the capitalist dynamics underpinning the reproduction of cloud capital, the way that these dynamics are fueling and reinforcing the genocide of the Palestinian people should be a significant part of your deliberations. Thank you.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, economist, politician, and activist, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey, in October 2025. Dr. Usama Maqdisi, professor of history at UC Berkeley, also spoke at the Gaza Tribunal final session about why Palestinians have been systematically dehistoricized and rendered a people without history or ethical importance. His talk is titled Root Causes Drawing on Historical Perspective. Let's take a listen.
Distinguished members of the jury of conscience, my name is Usama Maqdisi, a professor here at UC Berkeley in history. For 2 years, we have witnessed genocide. And for 2 years, the question that has haunted me and still haunts me is why, across so many parts of the liberal West that so solemnly proclaims the universality of law and human rights, is the professed concern with Jewish life consistently predicated on an obvious devaluation of Muslim and Christian Palestinian life? The question that concerns me and us is why and how Palestinians have been systematically dehistoricized. That is to say, how and why Palestinians have been rendered a people without history, without ethical or political importance, a people whose past and therefore present and future has been overwritten by a deeply pro-Israel, Eurocentric narrative. This overwriting of Palestinian history is a key prelude to the dehumanization and the genocide that we have witnessed. This devaluation of Palestinian and, of course, Arab and Muslim life more broadly, in fact, has a long history. After the Crusades and beginning with the Reformation, Protestant enthusiasts and theologians in Europe and North America fantasized about the idea of a return of the Jews to biblical Palestine, but they had no interest in the actually existing diverse population of actual Palestine, or for that matter, of the Jews of Europe. In the 19th century, the Zionist Jewish nationalist movement emerged among European Ashkenazi Jews, such as Theodor Herzl. But the Zionist movement too, at first, also ignored the native Palestinian population. Part of this, of course, was geography. Zionism was not born among the ancient Jewish communities of the East, but in Europe. Its leaders were not Arab or Eastern or Sephardic Jews, but European Ashkenazi Jews. Its ethno-religious nationalist ideology was forged not by the pluralism of the Middle East, but by the competing racial and ethnic and linguistic nationalisms of Europe. The racial anti-Semitism of the West, that was one of the main catalysts for European Jewish nationalism, was alien, of course, to the rhythms of religious difference and coexistence, so familiar to the diverse inhabitants of the Ottoman Islamic East. As Avi Shleim and Lana Tatur have just explained to you, the Zionist project developed as an openly colonialist project in an era, the 19th century, when European empires routinely segregated humanity into a hierarchy of superior and inferior races. So while leading Zionists such as Herzl grappled with the racial anti-Semitism of Europe, they were also desperate to belong to this Europe. They expressed, shared, contributed to, and circulated many of the foundational tropes of racism of 19th century Western culture, that the non-West was manifestly inferior, that the land of indigenous peoples was largely quote-unquote empty and thus open to colonization, and that the removal of native peoples was justifiable, inevitable, and necessary. Recall, of course, one of the most notorious slogans of the Zionist movement was a land without a people for a people without a land. The underlying point here is that both Christian and Jewish versions of colonial Zionism were predicated on solving Europe's so-called Jewish question, these are European terms, by removing or restoring Jews en masse to Palestine as if Palestinians did not exist and more fundamentally did not matter. What is astonishing is just how many significant proponents of colonial Zionism in Palestine, from Theodor Herzl to Arthur Balfour to W.E.B. Du Bois, all made variations of the same argument, that the Jewish people could not be assimilated into the Christian West, that they needed a national home of their own, that Palestine was a logical place to send them out of Europe, thus the transformation of multi-religious Palestine into a Jewish state was necessary to resolve Europe's so-called Jewish problem. The anti-Semitism in this Zionist proposition was either acknowledged obliquely or proclaimed or admitted openly, that Jews could not belong in Europe, and thus for their sake they had to be encouraged out of Europe to build a European state outside of Europe. The racist Orientalism that regarded the native Palestinian population as dispensable was simply taken for granted. From the outset of the Zionist colonial project in the 19th century, Palestinians were consistently deemed inferior, lacking history, and thus utterly irrelevant to a changing Western understanding of itself, whether we're talking about the 19th century, that explicitly was racist and colonial, or in the post-World War II era that claimed to repudiate anti-Semitism, that is to say, the West. So note that after World War II, members of the jury, U.S. politicians rejected allowing the survivors of the Holocaust into the United States, just as Arthur Balfour himself had at the turn of the 20th century rejected Eastern European Jewish immigration to England. But at the same time, U.S. politicians, journalists, and intellectuals across the United States and in Europe supported sending hundreds of thousands of Jewish displaced persons to Palestine in the name of decency and humanitarianism. Native Palestinians were entirely shut out of this decision-making process that most directly affected them. In November 1947, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of the population of Palestine was Palestinian, and despite centuries of Palestinian belonging on what had always been their land, their villages, their towns, and their homes, there was no consideration given to the fact that the idea of resolving Europe's Jewish question and then the question of displaced persons, in other words, Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, at their expense should be seriously challenged. Virtually every Western state that voted for partition in 1947 recognized that Palestinians existed, and this is what's different from the 19th century version. After World War II, the European powers and the United States recognized that Palestinians existed, and they also recognized that they would be harmed by any partition plan of Palestine. But they justified their vote for partition in 1947 by insisting that what happened to the Jews of Europe was a horror that needed urgent redress. In other words, they valued what happened in Europe far more than they valued what was going to happen in Palestine. And this redress, they said, embracing Zionist logic, could only occur in Palestine, even if it came at the expense of the Palestinians. The Nakba, which we heard about just now, or the Calamity of 1948, followed. Note that the co-author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt, rationalized and justified the uprooting of Palestinians. Roosevelt blamed the Palestinians for opposing their own displacement. She justified her support for colonial Zionism by dehistoricizing what she regarded as primitive, irrational, and aggressive Arabs. World War II and the creation of Israel in 1948 reflected, in short, more than just Western settler colonialism as a practice of native elimination. The support of Israel, the identification with Israel after 1948, reflected a reconstitution, or at least a claim to reconstitute, post-war Western humanism at the expense of the Palestinians. The creation of Israel as a Jewish state therefore represented an implied Western atonement for its own terrible past, or at least a claim to atone for this past. Israel, remember, received reparations from Germany in 1953. Israel was celebrated, recall, in the liberal and leftist Western world before it was celebrated in the conservative and anti-immigrant West that we see today. But it is crucial to point out that the war against Nazi racism, and specifically the Western repudiation of the virulent anti-Jewish ideology of the Nazi state, was not predicated on a Western rejection of colonialism more broadly. France fought bitterly to remain in Algeria. Britain fought bitterly to remain in Kenya. The US supported Jim Crow segregation in the US South and all supported apartheid South Africa. My point is that support for the new state of Israel after 1948, established outside of Europe in the name of the Jewish people after the Holocaust, was key to a reconstitution of post-war Western humanism, a sense of belonging in the world, a sense of leading the world. Palestinians, however, did not figure in this moral calculus, nor did most of the rest of the colonized world. This Western denial of an ancient, sustained, and meaningful Palestinian relationship to Palestine has had profoundly corrosive moral, political, and ethical effects. I appeal to members of the jury to see that these effects in Gaza, in the Gaza genocide, are playing out today in the 21st century. Thank you.
That was Dr. Osama Maqdisi, professor of history at UC Berkeley, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey, in October 2025. More information about the Gaza Tribunal is at www.gazatribunal.com. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.